And welcome back. Tragedies, tragedies, tragedies. 9/11, of course, was the big one. I look at Lahaina as a micro 9/11. Same sort of strange circumstances that people are going to be talking about for a long time and trying to ferret the truth out of the lies and disinformation, of which there is already a deluge of. Just extraordinary. Here's a new book on 9/11. Now, how many books have been written on 9/11? Thousands, probably, around the world. This book is called Unanswered Questions by Ray McGinnis. And it's quite an interesting book because it acts like an advocate for the families of those who died and those who suffered. And I guess there are still people sick right now, those who haven't died off. It has to do with questions that the 9/11 Commission ignored, questions that Ray McGinnis brought up and put in a book form and reposes. What is going on? Ray, welcome to the program. Thanks for being here.
Great to speak with you, Jeff.
Thank you, sir. What prompted you to do this? There have been so many books on 9/11. This is a bit of a different angle, though. I have to say it's very salutary. Good job.
Thank you. Well, I'm, in my life at that around, before 9/11, I was my career as a self-employed writing instructor. I was teaching journal writing workshops, going to healthcare facilities, helping people to write about their recovery from injury and loss, helping grief support groups use a journal to write about their journey through grief and loss.
Robert, excuse me. I didn't know that, Robert. I didn't know this at all, Ray. And no, I just had Robert on last hour. I didn't know this about you. And I was just thinking, I was a high school teacher for a couple of years, and I was so appalled then at how stupid, I guess, dumbed down the students were that writing, and you're teaching people how to write. I can't even imagine doing that now or trying to do that now. What is your opinion of the contemporary capability of what's left of this culture in terms of writing and expressing itself? And good on you for trying to help people, because writing is a dying art, just like reading is, Ray. It's the same thing.
Well, I think it's a really important skill for people to be able to, move, from the inner turmoil, especially if you're going through, confusion or grief or loss or, trying to seek clarity. When you spend some time in quiet silence and start to write about, what your dreams are or how you're going to move through this difficult time or whatever it happens to be, you start to bring forth your own inner wisdom that you may not know was there to write about. And I think it's a real godsend for so many people. And so I was helping people, memoir writing workshops, helping grandparents write snapshots of their lives to pass on to their grandchildren and so on.
Nice.
And so my segue into why would I write about the 9/11 families and the family steering committee for the 9/11 independent commission that forced the Bush administration to have an investigation in the first place. I happened upon, in 2001, on September 11th, I was in Joshua Tree State Park with 60 Americans. I was the only person. I was Canadian, and so I got to see firsthand the reaction of people all around me, including my own. I didn't see it on TV. I just heard about it. We heard at this retreat setting.
Wow! Without seeing it, talk about challenging the mind. Just hearing about it without seeing it. Most everyone saw it, and then okay, fascinating.
Yeah. And two of the people in that room in Joshua Tree at the retreat center had a finance officer who lived, but at the time they didn't know if that person who worked in one of the towers was alive. Mm-hmm. So it was very difficult.
Sure.
But fast forward, up in Vancouver in Canada, the 9/11 Commission got very little press. I mean, you know, in the summer of 2004, the report came out. Maybe I heard about it. I did see Condoleezza Rice speaking on a TV at one point, swearing before the commission, but otherwise it really was not on my radar. So I happened to pick up a book in 2007, I think, at an airport, looking for a new book to read as I'm traveling. And Kristen Breitweiser, whose husband Ron died in South Tower, had written a memoir called Wake Up Call, The Political Education of a 9/11 Widow. And she was one of the dozen people on this family steering committee. And I thought, this is 6 years after the attacks, I thought, how is it that the press here in Canada hasn't covered this angle? Because I had no sense that if it really hadn't been for the families, that there probably, you know, would not have been an investigation. I mean, Lee Hamilton and Tom Keene, the co-chairs of the 9/11 Commission, said, if it wasn't for these families, we wouldn't be here. So I thought it was a really interesting story about citizen advocacy. And I didn't, in 2007, was not my intention to write a book. I acquainted myself with the website that the Family Steering Committee had, with their questions that were left unanswered. And the years went by, and I began to create a file folder in my computer with some of the open source, you know, Washington Post, New York Times, and other articles that they cited that helped them form their questions for different cabinet ministers, the Bush administration, different agencies. And as the years went by, I thought, you know, this is an important story. And what I wanted to do, I knew that there were a lot of, you know, hard scrabble political science books out there, plus a lot of books about, you know, the day and, you know, the first responders and other things. But I thought, I want to write a book that the people taking my writing workshops, and most of those people have been women in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. I want to, and most of the people, smart people, but not especially, like, they're not people sitting and watching Crossfire on CNN. They're not like political junkies. But I thought, this is an important story. So if I write a book that introduces the reader to the grief, the shift from grief and loss to advocacy to go to knock on doors in Washington, D.C., and walk people through how the commission started and the monitoring by the families, introducing snippets of testimony by the families during the commission, and then the questions, some of the questions that are left unanswered, and showcasing how the families as a group are not all on the same page in terms of their takeaway from all this. Some are accepting of the official account. Others think there's a cover-up. Others want a new investigation or a lawsuit. But I had to sort of write it in that way so that at the end of the book, I'm not telling the reader what to think, but I'm saying, put yourself in the position of a 9/11 commissioner. What would you think about this?
Exactly. Yeah. I don't know, honestly, much about the commission, to be totally honest. I just don't. It's been a long time. I don't know what the families were trying to do with this. Where were they going? Were they just trying to find satisfaction about the circumstances of how their loved ones perished? What were they doing? What was the impetus of all this? The unanswered questions.
Yeah. Well, I'll just read you a little bit of what Mindy Kleinberg, whose husband Alan died in North Tower, said before the commission on the 31st of March, 2003. And she said, with regard to the 9/11 attacks, it's been said that the intelligence agencies have to be right 100% of the time, and the terrorists only have to get lucky once. This explanation, she says, for the devastating attack September 11th, simple on its face, is wrong in its value, because the 9/11 terrorists were not lucky just once. They were lucky over and over and over again. Is it luck that aberrant stock trades were not monitored? Is it luck when 15 visas are awarded based on incomplete forms? Like, what year were you born? 1878? Is it luck when airline security screenings allow hijackers to board planes with box cutters and pepper spray? And she goes on and talks about, you know, the lack of timely reporting to the top government officials. She says, to me, luck is something that happens once. But when you have this repeated pattern of broken protocols, broken laws, broken communication, one can still not call it luck. So they wanted to know, like, you know, what has really gone wrong? The sense of the families, and the majority of these people who I'm following most closely voted for President Bush, so they're Republican voters.
Right.
But they wanted the government to make the nation safe so that nobody ever had to walk in their shoes.
Got it. I understand. Okay. The committee itself, the commission, I should say, how, this is 2003, how amenable were they to entertaining the wishes of the families, the grievances of the families? Now, now Kristen Breitweiser, you mentioned she wrote a very good coverage about this, and that's what you saw and it got you interested, but were they being given the cold shoulder by that time? I mean, you talk about good luck. There's no luck in this thing. It was all planned. Everybody knows that now. So tell me, I'm curious about the commission and how they were acting.
Well, the commission from the start, I mean, the government, the Bush administration didn't want an investigation. Yeah, they didn't want an investigation. They finally appointed Dr. Henry Kissinger to head up the commission. The families met with Dr. Kissinger in the families meet with Dr. Kissinger in early December 2002, and they did some checking up on him, and at one point Lori Van Auken and his husband Kenneth died in the North Tower. Said, you know, Dr. Kissinger, we just want to make sure you don't have any conflicts of interest, that you don't have any clients by the name of Bin Laden. And he'd been serving them coffee, you know, and at that point he spilled coffee all over the coffee table and nearly fell off the couch. And the next day he resigned, who knows why exactly. But, then they hire, Tom Keene and Lee Hamilton. And Lee Hamilton was involved in the October surprise investigation and the Iran-Contra investigation. And was also a good buddy. Hamilton and his wife would often go on vacations with Dick Cheney and his wife and Donald Rumsfeld and his wife. So, the families, the families didn't know that so much about, they sort of more or less find out about who the 10 commissioners are.
The families didn't, at the 2003, yet understand the depths and the depravity of this whole cover-up operation. They didn't see it then. They thought that they were going to get a fair shake somehow, right?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, this. I mean, this. Yeah. I mean, you have. I mean, there's all kinds of emotional and psychological layers to this. First of all, there's one less person sitting at the dining room, at the kitchen table each day in your family. So they're carrying that grief, which is still very palpable. And they really want to believe that their government is going to do the right thing and just get to the bottom of what happened and fix whatever, right? You know. So, and they also are under pressure in the media because they can't be seen to have like an axe to grind against the government, or else some sectors of the media are going to say, oh, these people are just complainers, or nobody can satisfy them, and or whatever. So whenever anyone aimed low, they went high and tried to hoping that their meetings with people would go well. But by September of 2003, they issued 50 press releases during the life of the 9/11 Commission report. In September of 2003, they issued a report card, and that report card was pretty damning of the 9/11 Commission in terms of how it was proceeding and not transparency, not you know, not very good transparency. They wanted there to be subpoenas. There were no subpoenas. The position of the commission was Lee Hamilton said, well, we don't want to make the NSA or the Pentagon have to be receiving subpoenas because it might upset the White House. And so, you know, this kind of softball approach of what was going on was really disturbing the families, and so they gave a D grade for investigative, informative, open hearings. Initially, they had been promised, you know, more than twice as many open hearings as they ended up getting. And part of that is because they found out that, I mean, Lee Hamilton, the vice chair, didn't think that having any public hearings was a good idea at all. So they come up against these kinds of points of view that just seem to be, you know, bewildering, you know. Another key thing I'll mention that they come up when you ask about the course of the 9/11 Commission is that, I mean, we've got the 10 people who are the face, the commissioners, the 10 commissioners are the face of the commission. But behind that are 80 staff, including the executive director, Bill Zelikow. And in March and April of 2004, the families learn that the previous year in March of 2003, the executive director and another senior commission staff had drawn up an outline of for the whole report with the chapter headings and subheadings. And it happens to be that when the report came out, that almost all of the chapter headings and subheadings of the report itself mirror that outline. And for the families and for numbers of commission staff themselves, they said, hey, wait a minute. When you want to do an investigation, you want to interview people, see where those interviews lead, follow wherever the path goes, and turn over whatever rocks you need to. But if you decide before you're going to do an investigation, what you will conclude, that's, you know, it's like the fix is in. You're rigging the investigation.
Oh, yeah. Certainly. When you talk to these people, I don't know when you began to write the book. What time frame do you have? When did you start to work on this? Approximately.
Yeah, I started writing the book. I mean, I made a run at it around, you know, 2011, 2012. It was all written more in the first person and kind of anyway, I changed that whole thing around. Then I started writing it, you know, the book that people see now in about 2016. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, and I was finished with the copy editors and proof readers by spring
and the reason,
by June
the reason
of 2021.
Is that I'm just kind of curious. I hate to use the term victim, but how many 9/11 victim families did you talk to during the process, approximately?
I talked to 8 or 9. I mean, it's hard. I'm not a journalist, so I don't have
a
calling
card. Hey, you teach writing.
Like,
you're a journalist. Come on.
Yeah, I'm a journalist. Yeah, but I don't have the same cachet as someone who says, "Hi, I'm calling from the Los Angeles Times. I'd like to speak with you."
Well, if I had that call, I'd hang up real quick. That's not an organ of truth and information in my book. It's a part of the mainstream media cover-up. The same people you're talking about in the book. These are bad people. We no longer have a free press. You know that. Anybody, honestly,
I do.
Who looks at the situation, it's tragic what's happened to this country. And you're mentioning that you had no visuals about 9/11 when you first heard about it. That's remarkable. Most people in this country no longer are proactive about life or liberty or the pursuit of happiness. They are reactive. They stare at the screen, and for most of them, that constitutes a very substantial portion of their reality. Unfortunately, it's crafted and created by the people you're talking about here, the controllers. They do it. They own it. They own the medium, and they use it to full advantage. It's called, you know, reactive life. It's not proactive. They're just staring and reacting. And that's a real tough thing. When you teach writing, you're teaching it to people who often are learning how to be proactive again. They, for years, have just floated along, reacting to stuff, I would think.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. And taking your own charge of your own life, your own agency. And I happen to be, I mean, it was my response to the news coverage of the Persian Gulf War back in, what, 91 or so. Yeah. I decided not to keep a TV. So I haven't had a television in my home since 1991.
Wow.
And
that's a revolutionary concept. Good job, Ray. Very good. Not many people can say that. No.
Well, and you know, as you're asking about this, what if instead I'd had, you know, 5 or 6 years full of images from the news in my, you know, all that stuff in my head.
Oh yeah.
You know, would I have written the book that I've written? Would I have been curious?
No.
In the way that I've
You're not objective
curious?
Anymore.
No.
You're programmed.
Yeah.
No, you can't help it.
Yeah.
Just too much data.
Yeah.
You can't unsee it all. It's there, and it's obscuring one's ability to see things with clarity. It just does. Too much noise. All right. Hold on just a minute. Talking with Ray McGinnis about his book, Unanswered Questions. And we'll come back with more in just a few minutes. Okay, and we're back with Ray McGinnis, whose book, Unanswered Questions About 9/11, gives you a completely different take on and a perspective on this tragedy. How are these people doing today? Did the families ever get any satisfaction out of any of the government schmutz that was thrown at them?
It goes in different directions. There are some families... Carrie Lemack, for one, who was on the Family Steering Committee, she went on to produce a documentary called Killing in the Name about Islamic terrorism that got an Academy Award nomination for a short documentary in 2010. And you know, she would be completely on side with the official account.
That was 13 years ago already.
Yeah.
13 years. It's amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. I when I write my book, I have to include the family members that, you know, end up being part of the 9/11, the new 9/11 Museum and Memorial, and, you know, mm-hmm. accept the official account. And then there's other families, I mean, like the Jersey girls, who were Mindy Kleinberg, Lori Van Auken, and Patty Casaza, and Kristen Breitweiser. They said they wrote a letter to Patrick Leahy, Senator Patrick Leahy, and they said at the 9/11 Commission hearing, this is like about 13 years ago, again, they're writing to him all these years, you know, after the commission happened. At the 9/11 Commission hearings, they say little actual evidence was ever produced. Many individuals were not sworn in. Critical witnesses were either not called to testify or were permitted to dictate the parameters of their own questioning. And pertinent questions were omitted, and there was little follow-up. So I saw somebody say something as a witness, which might be quite a thing to follow up on. But then maybe Tom Keene would say, okay, time's up. I'll give you an example. Donald Rumsfeld is asked, did you order fighter jets to defend the Pentagon? And he answers by doing this. he looks around, sees the wallpaper, the ceiling fixtures, the paint on the wall, and whatever else. And then eventually he says, he repeats the question he's been asked. And after he simply repeats the question he's been posed, Tom Keene, the chair of the commission, bangs the gavel and says, "Time's up, next question."
Oh, my.
Yeah. You know, I mean, the commissioners only have, each commissioner has 5 minutes to ask the witness on the stand questions. Mm-hmm. I think they one of them, I'm not sure if it was Condoleezza Rice, but one of the commissioners asked one of the women who was there to testify, they said, you know, "That's a really great hairdo. I love your slacks."
Come on.
I mean, and you can imagine for the families who have given over 1,000 questions for the commissioners to...
That's just mockery. Mocking those people.
Yeah.
Rumsfeld, former Secretary of Defense, and he couldn't even throw a pretend answer that made any sense out. He just stalled.
Yeah.
Unreal. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I guess at some point the families knew that they were just being played. They had to, and I don't know. That's a pretty tough. See, those were different days then. Now we look at the alleged government in Washington. Now you're up in Canada, but you know what we've got here. We've been overthrown by Bolshevik communists. I'm not speaking for Ray McGinnis here. I'm just saying that's my take.
Yeah.
And the country's being taken down. Now I was told this over 6 years ago now that this was coming. I was told by a source that we are pulling the plug on the United States. It's done. You better get ready. We're doing the same thing in Europe. Western Europe is gone. And they've made these plans, and 9/11 was part of their plans. They've been planning this for many decades, and they've got time on their side. They own the media, therefore they own reality for most people. It's sad to say, but it's true. That Rumsfeld is what a horrible man. Every time I hear his name, I think aspartame and how many lives he's ruined with that. This is awful stuff.
Yeah. So your listeners will not be surprised that when Patty Casazza, whose husband John died in the North Tower, said years later, you know, when she was asked, you know, she said to a reporter, "These people who supposedly hijacked these planes, many of these people, like Osama bin Laden himself, were once our own patsies," she says. "I still don't think I have come to terms with how September 11th happened, why it happened, and who actually perpetrated these crimes that day."
Huh.
And, you know, that's part of the damning assessment of families. That I want to say that because they're always kind of in the eye of the needle with media, you know, being scrutinizing their every word.
Yes.
I mean, there are families who want to take, you know, Saudi Arabia, the government, and certain Saudi officials to court. And I want to comment on that in this way. Some of the families simply think that if the government, which through multiple administrations is stonewalling and obstructing every attempt to try and get Saudi officials in a court setting with them, some of the families simply think we're just going to go and get certain Saudi officials to take responsibility and maybe go to jail, whatever. But other families think, you know, in a court of law, you can have whistleblowers, you can have surprise witnesses. You may even have people in a certain Saudi official maybe who will want, in order to defend themselves, to bring certain American officials to into the, you know, subpoena them to come into the court and maybe talk about dereliction of duty or much worse. I think the families who want a court case with Saudis, it may not just be about Saudi Arabia after all.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah.
It isn't.
Yeah.
How much of the totality of the whole operation do you think we have a fairly good handle on by this time? Half? Two-thirds?
Maybe half to two-thirds. Well, I mean, people who are paying attention, who've, you know, read you know, things that you can read that, that raise questions and scrutinize certainly have, you know, I mean, I've talked to Bob McElvain, whose son Bobby died, and he talks about how his son was walking into, I think it was the North Tower, but one of the towers, and didn't even really make it in because he was blown out of the towers. There was an explosion, and his son was one of the very first people who was taken to a morgue to be, you know, looked at by
he
coroners.
He was blown, okay, excuse me, Ray, hold on. He was going into... Yeah. The tower, and he was blown out of the tower, out the door, so to speak. In other words, the explosion was that intense. Now, this is not the explosion of the collapse of the tower. This is early on.
No.
I mean, we all remember in our mind's eye how the tower comes down, and obviously putting a lot of force below it. Each floor that collapses or is blown, and it gets to the bottom with a tremendous head of steam, and that energy could have blown anybody out of there. But this was an explosive charge of some kind that blew him out of the building. That's what you're saying.
I'm just quoting what he said. He said that he learned his son Bobby was entering the North Tower lobby when his son was killed by a blast from a detonation. He says Bobby had lacerations all over his chest from flying glass. The blast was strong enough to blow Bobby out of his laced shoes, that, you know, he was one of the first people who was already in, you know, being looked at in a morgue before the first tower came down.
That's a remarkable little vignette right there. That's something.
Yeah.
This thing was so incredibly well planned. I still am amazed at how they got those buildings to pretty much come down in their own footprints. It was quite a job. The original bombing, if you remember, who was that phony sheikh that was involved with the subterranean blast that killed 7 or 8 people some years before? They were trying to actually knock one of the towers down, have it fall over. That was the idea, if you remember that one. That was the first attempt to take him down.
The truck bomb in, I think, February of 1993.
Yeah.
And,
The idea was that thing was supposed to fall over. Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
I know. Yeah, I have an odd connection. I had friends at the time. I was living in Toronto back then, and I had friends who one of them was a friend of John D. Giovanni. Was one of the 6 or 7 people killed. I think he was a janitor who worked in the buildings, and he happened. So it was, what are the chances I'd be just degrees of separation away from that story? And I actually had been in the Windows on the World in the North Tower back in 1981. I was taken up by friends who lived in northern New Jersey, took me up. So I'd been in the towers, you know, while they were, you know, years before. So.
Wow. All right. At this time, what are we, how many years, 23, what are we?
22 years,
Almost 23. How many people have died after the fact from the horrible air that they were told was clean and pure? Has anyone tracked that to your knowledge? It's a little bit off the road here, but I'm just curious how many have died who would have been viable witnesses. We've lost, you know, most all the witnesses because they died after they got sick and died.
Yeah, I mean, they're, you know, the first responders that rescued people and people who are working on at Ground Zero and in the weeks and many months afterwards, you know, many people sick. So I'm guessing it's be over 1,000. I'm just ballpark guessing, but you know, so and many, many thousands, if over 10,000 or more that have, you know, very sick.
Well, their lives have been shortened.
I'm not always good with statistics. I have them right in front of my face.
No,
but
that's okay.
I know I mentioned John Field.
Do you know the name William Rodriguez? He was
a
janitor. He was a wonderful guy. I had him on the program here, I don't know how many times, a lot, and just told an astounding story of explosions in the sub-basement level, blasts, and his involvement and all that. He was the last man out of the North Tower. Remarkable yeah. man. Yeah. So much yeah. to this. If they only tell the truth.
I've talked to Chris Gioia, who was with the Franklin Square and Munson Fire Department, who had been involved with trying to get firefighters these many years later to try and get their associations to have an investigation. It seems that whenever you're dealing with official, government or organizations, whether it's the architects and engineers that want to have a new investment, whatever it is, they always run into this stiff resistance at the organizational level of their sectors or the government itself.
Right.
And even there's a guy called Jeff Campbell, who was a Brit who died in the North Tower. His family, Matt Campbell and the brother Matt Campbell and other, his mother, Jeff's mother, in London recently were trying to have a new inquest into Jeff Campbell's death. And the judge in London, England, said, no, we can't look at this again. So even though this is a story in America, but even for people who are citizens from other countries, when they try and look under the rock and get people in official positions to revisit, the story, because the collapse, the pancake down stuff that Cheney said just doesn't add up, you get people in official positions saying, no, we're not going to look at this. So it's a problem with Western democracy.
It's well, remember what I said, that Western Europe, the U.S., Canada, Australia, New Zealand, they're all being taken down. These are first world, we'll call them white, Western Christian cultures. They are targeted. That's the first wave of the globalist attack. That's their agenda, and they're well on the way to achieving it. I'm speaking for myself now, not Ray.
Yeah.
One of the reviews of your book cuts right to the heart of the matter. He says, the person writes, as soon as I saw Building 7 fall, I thought 9/11 was an inside job. And this book provides limitless evidence to support this view. Recommended for any doubters. Is it really you got some really nice reviews here. The book's available on Amazon, of course. Unanswered Questions, What the September 11th Families Asked and the 9/11 Commission Ignored. It's all right here. Go ahead.
It's been great to have the reviews and numbers of reviews by family members as well. So it's I think too that hopefully the way I've written the book it can also be a useful book for people that perhaps their starting point would be to say, well, I don't believe in conspiracy theories, and so this is a book where it's a chronicle of what the families themselves did to try and get an investigation. So
they ran into one never-ending conspiracy against them, against the truth,
yeah.
against reality. Just really dreadful stuff. There's things involved in the book centering around coincidences. Are you being facetious about that, coincidences? Or were there coincidences that really were coincidences?
Well, I frame it in that way because the way that a lot of people in the culture we're in, there is such a stiff resistance to consider that anything nefarious can be going on. People use the term conspiracy theory to sort of wave away any scrutiny of what's going on. And so I build up a list, just from looking at a dozen of the questions. I've got, 15, 18 coincidences. And at some point, you have to ask a person, how many coincidences do you need before you think that something else is going on here?
I'm of the school now that there are no coincidences of any real merit or significance or substance anymore when it comes to things like this. It's all being controlled.
Yeah.
The level of control is so damned complete. It is too much for most people to consider. They just don't believe it.
Yeah.
They can't believe it. And yet it's now with AI watching and changing and manipulating and if we got 2/3 of the truth, we've done very well as a dedicated population with people like you really doing the boots on the ground research, was talking to the families. These are invaluable assets. Anyway, good.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I think that I would say too that, you know, I mean, my book was about the family's efforts. It wasn't a book to chronicle the story of the 9/11 truth movement, which would have been a different kind of book to write about.
You painted quite a human picture of this. These are victims, they're grieving. Yeah. Of course, go ahead.
Yeah. Yeah. And of course, like, if I think about the 9/11 truth movement, you've got all kinds of different people motivated to find out whatever they think is there to find out, mm-hmm. with different takes on different things. They don't agree about, you know, what happened at the Pentagon or other things. And I think that, that, you know, hopefully one day, and I don't know, it's more like a miracle, but, you know, if there was a court of law that could, you know, have a proper investigation where there's discovery and people have to take oaths and, you know, consequence of perjury and so on, you know, that would be a good thing to have happen, you know, because the story that we've been told cannot be true and isn't true. And if a nation and a world builds their understanding of what's gone on in the past based on lies, then it's terribly toxic, you know, for the whole culture. And as you know,
well said. So. Oh yeah, yeah. No, I've waded through this many programs and off air times, and I used to talk to William among others, and you know, the truth of what happened there was so egregiously buried and suppressed by a complicit media. It's one of the great crimes against America. That cover-up is awful, just awful. It's not the only one. It goes on all the time. In fact, it was a trendsetter. Ray, we're almost out of time. Last quick question here. If there was one question that you could answer, or have answered, what would that question be? With the truth, if you could submit one question, what would be? That's a tough one because you got a lot of them. But what one thing would you like to really know about this mess? What would you ask?
Well,
you don't have to answer if you don't. There's too much out there. I just threw it out there. If there was one thing that really tweaked you and bothered you that you'd like to have a straight answer about, what might that be? Now, you've been advocating for the families, so I'm asking you, what would Ray want?
Well, I think the collapse of Building 7 certainly tweaked my attention, and
right.
I think it's clear that building didn't fall down because fire.
No.
So, you know, I think that I have an article that's come out with the American Journal of Economics and Sociology that people unfortunately have to pay for to read, but it's looking at the history of think tanks in America and the mm-hmm. Trilateral Commission and the Bilderberg Group and the Council on Foreign Relations, and it just seems that there's a curious relationship between key people going back to the 1920s with the Council on Foreign Relations and people in key positions in successive administrations. So
Yeah.
You know, they seem to be interested in moving these things along. And Patty Casazza was really curious about Zbigniew Brzezinski. So, you know.
Right. Got it. Very good. Congratulations again, Ray, and thanks for standing up for the families and working for the truth for them. They deserve a lot. You've helped. Thank you.
Well, great pleasure to be on your show. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Ray. Take care. All right. Ray McGinnis, and it is a very unusual book on the subject. Unanswered Questions, Amazon, Ray McGinnis. Okay, talk to you tomorrow on Friday. You take care. Talk soon.